The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. It's All-Star Day here at PYC at Edstone, where the campers are getting ready for some of their, or playing some of their final sports games before their awards night tonight, and then everyone will be leaving for going back home tomorrow. And then we'll be very quickly back into the school year. Orientation starts on Monday. I'm back into teaching with international relations in exactly one week's time. So time is flying by. The summer break is practically over. And there's been a lot of important developments, a lot of good commentary, a lot of some excellent articles over the last few days. And in the second half of the program, I'm going to see how many of those we can get through. But I want to spend the first half of the program today talking in more detail about a very important rising power, Turkey. At a time when North Korea is jumping up and down, waving madly, saying, look at me, it can be easy to forget some of these other powers. And, you know, yes, North Korea, we will get to you later in the program if we have time. But Turkey is going through a massive transformation, and it's not one that necessarily has a huge number of big headline news events that scream for attention, but more gradually its role in the world, its allies, even its very identity are up for grabs. And it's a significant shift, and it's a shift that's well worth paying attention to. And there's a famous saying about Britain, that Britain lost its empire and has not yet found a role. Turkey, on the other hand, it found a role very quickly after losing its empire. The Ottoman Empire finally came crashing down during World War I after years, decades, centuries perhaps even of decay. And having once dominated the Middle East, North Africa, parts of Europe, Kemal Atatürk refounded the nation as a secular, Western-oriented state. And that's the way Turkey remained for decades. They joined NATO later, became a key part of the West against communism. And now all of this is changing, and there's a whole load of questions about who their allies are going to be. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been bringing Islam into politics. He's been rejecting now some of the West's democratic norms, drawing closer to Russia at the expense of some of those other NATO allies. Where is Turkey heading? That's a very important question for all of us. It's a nation, Mr. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has called it the crossroads of the world. It's played a crucial role in world events, and it's going to, again, in a way that strongly affects the United States. Mr. Flurry has repeatedly drawn attention to the importance of watching Turkey. And here's a segment from a Key of David that he gave on this subject a few years ago.
God says in Obadiah 13 and 14, this book about Esau, or Turkey, as well as some spiritual Edomites, or spiritual people with that Esau attitude. But it says that there that Turkey is at the crossway. What does that mean? Well, it means the crossroads of the world. We have to look at this geopolitically and try to get the vision here of what it means. This is a giant gate, sea gate, in the Bosphorus at the north of Turkey and the Dardanelles at the south of Turkey, and especially controlled by European Turkey. And look, you have to understand what this all means. If you don't have these gateways, and if you don't have, for example, if Russia, after winning all that power in World War II, was not able to come through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles out into the Mediterranean for world trade, they could never have sustained their world power. It's about world power. And that is something we don't seem to understand in America and Britain. Britain has already lost out in that part of the world. They used to control that part of the world, and that's when they were a world power. But they've lost it and all that power with it. And America is going the same direction. And it's almost there. How much influence do you think we have in that part? How much geopolitical influence, let's say, do we have in the crossroads of the world and in the Middle East and that surrounding area? How much influence does America have? It's all about world power. You need to read the history books and realize that if you lose out in that area, you lose everything, or potentially so anyhow. That's a critical seagate of this world, and it is controlled right now by Turkey, but only because the U.S. has backed and supported them and kept it from Russia. They would have taken it if we hadn't helped Turkey. But again, you can have all kinds of space age power and jet planes and all of that, all kinds of technology and airplanes. But look, it's still about world trade, which is transported mainly by ships as we get those raw materials and minerals from the soil. They have to be shipped mainly by large ships. And that's where the seagate, that crossroads of the world, comes in. Because all of those goods from Russia flow right through there out into the Mediterranean and around the world. Russia has that warm sea outlet there, and it means everything to their stature in the world and their power in this world. They have a naval base in Syria. Why would they want to be in Syria? Well, because they want to control the crossroads of the world. They want to control the Middle East. They want to put themselves in a position where they can bring down other powers. That's what it's all about. Now again, Russia, without that, would not be a world power.
So that's a great introduction there for what we want to talk about today, about the importance of Turkey, the importance of that crossroads of the world. Turkey's geography makes it a really significant power. It's in the east, it's a rugged mountain fortress that controls the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which guarantees it a powerful role in the Middle East. It controls that exit to the Black Sea there, with the Dardanelles, giving it power to block Russia's trade and its naval power. It controls the shortest and most direct routes from the Middle East into Europe. Robert Kaplan, in his book The Revenge of Geography, wrote that in the early 21st century, Turkey boasted a vibrant and politically dominant Islamic movement, an immense military capacity compared to almost any country in the Middle East save Israel, an economy that has grown 8% annually for many years and still managed over 5% growth during the worldwide recession, and a dam system that made Turkey a water power to the same extent that Iran and Saudi Arabia were oil powers. These factors, seen and unseen, allow Turkey to compete with Iran for the locus of Islamic leadership and legitimacy. So they're a major power geographically, they're a major power even religiously, and they're rapidly rising in importance in the area, even still. It's been supporting Qatar recently. That's been in the headlines a lot, as Saudi Arabia withdraws from Qatar and starts to pile on the pressure. Turkey has been supporting them, even increasing their military presence in the area. Their military spending is going through a massive boost. They already have, I believe it's the second largest military in NATO, second only to the United States. So a huge, huge manpower, and they're boosting their spending. That increased by about 10% over the last year, by over 10%. They're taking their massive military force and making it more mobile as well, so that they can project power much more throughout the region. Probably the biggest symbol of this is their announcement that they want to build their own aircraft carrier. They're working on a smaller aircraft carrier already, And aircraft carriers really are the ultimate symbol of power projection. There's only 12 nations that operate aircraft carriers right now. And Turkey, they're building a light aircraft carrier that should be complete in 2020. And that could end up carrying 8 F-35B stealth fighter jets, you know, ultra-modern fighter jets. And no other nation in the Middle East has that kind of capacity. In July, President Erdogan announced his goal of building a full-sized aircraft carrier. And you know, Egypt is the only other Middle Eastern power that has its own aircraft carriers. It has the French Mistral-class amphibious assault ships, but that can carry helicopters. It can't carry fighter jets and certain types. It can only carry certain types of other aircraft. So they've got this unrivaled ability among Middle Eastern powers to project power away from their borders as well. And they're increasing their military bases and things like that across the region. As I mentioned, it's resisted calls to shut down its Qatar base. And in fact, as Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states started cracking down on Qatar, Turkey fast-tracked a bill to station 3,000 troops there. Last year, it finished building a base in Somalia. And there it's going to help train forces to fight the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. Paul Idden on War is Boring recently wrote that, in short, the Turkish military isn't confining itself to within its own borders or even within its own region. So they're spreading their influence throughout the region, like they used to do in the days of the Ottoman Empire. Turkey's rollercoaster relationship with Russia has been kind of the big thing in the headlines. They, two of them, for example, have been talking about Turkey buying the S-300 missile system. Just a few years ago, 2015, people were talking about war between Turkey and Russia after Turkey shot down a fighter jet. Then the two suddenly made up, and now they're new BFFs, best friends forever. Turkey's buying important pieces of Russian-made weaponry, as we said, and they're clashing with their previous allies, most notably Germany. And there have been a lot of headlines about the two of these powers falling out recently, about Erdogan accusing Germany of harboring terrorists, for example, which, of course, Erdogan, terrorist, just seems to mean somebody I don't like. But you know, experts are openly fretting now that NATO could lose Turkey to the Russians. Now, when you look beneath the surface, it's a little bit of a different picture. Turkey, the spat between Turkey and Germany has a lot of sound and fury and perhaps not as much substance under the surface. Turkey, for example, they haven't backed out of their deal with Germany to limit refugees. That's despite the fact that Germany has completely failed to persuade the rest of the EU to live up to its side of the bargain. So Turkey has ways that they could really hurt Germany if they wanted to, but they haven't, which suggests that they don't want a break like that with Germany. And at the same time, German companies are playing a huge role in the military revival of Turkey. Hanselblatt last week, they had an article titled "Turkish Military Power Made by Germany?" And they wrote that Germany, Turkey's most important trade partner, has traditionally played an important role in the building of Ankara's military power. They talked about how Rheinmetall is helping to develop Turkey's next main battle tank through its stake in a Turkish Qatari company, BMC. They wrote that the Dusseldorf-based arms company installed former defense minister and sitting parliamentarian Franz Josef Jung on its supervisory board for the express purpose of expanding business ties with Ankara. They talked about how ThyssenKrupp was exporting submarines to Turkey and about, quote, in the next phase, plan to work with local Turkish partners to export these weapon systems to Indonesia. Hanselblatt talked about how Turkey is trying to make its defense industry more self-sufficient and about how German companies are setting up local subsidiaries in Turkey. And they called this a win-win situation for both sides because it helps Turkey boost its arms industry and at the same time it helps German companies get around the German government's fairly strict rules as to who they can and can't export and sell German weapons to companies without it necessarily showing up on the German exports and imports. So it's a partner for Germany to use to expand its relationships with a whole lot of other companies. Turkish military power made by Germany. That was the headline in Handelsblatt, as I said. And keep that in, we'll listen to another clip from a program, Key of David program for Mr. Flurry. But as we listen to that, keep this headline very firmly in mind.
But Turkey, again, has been allied with Iran. But why would they be siding up to Germany? Well, because they disagree with Iran in this revolution that's going on. They're behind and support the rebels, while Iran supports the Assad regime. So there, it looks like there's problems between Turkey and Iran, and of course, we know there's going to be, because Turkey's going to be allied with Germany. And they're going to, Germany is driving a wedge between those two great countries, Turkey and Iran. What does that mean to people in this world? Well, it means very little, because they don't know what's going on. But God prophesied all of it and spells it out and says, if we'll just study our Bibles, we can understand that. We must understand it. God has his little treasured ones or sheltered ones there because he protects them, and they understand it. Do you understand this? We really do need to. Well, you watch what happens in with Turkey and Germany and all of these other nations. Just watch and see what happens and see if they don't break away from Iran. And after Germany defeats Iran, then they're all going to already virtually be allied with Germany. You see, those things don't happen overnight. It takes time. And Germany has been laying that groundwork for many years. And that you can prove from your world news. It's just that it flies under the radar most of the time. People don't realize what's really happening, but we're talking about a massive shift in nations of this world and events that are going to just stagger the imagination of many authorities in this world. And God had it all planned out long ago, or prophesied long ago. He let others do a lot of the planning.
So there you go. You heard him say, you watch and see. Watch Turkey's relationship with Germany. Watch their relationship with Iran. See where they end up. And now you have headlines like Turkish military power made by Germany. It's happening. And Mr. Flurry talks in there about how the Syrian war would divide Germany, divide Turkey and Iran, and it has done that to a certain extent. Both do have some kind of relationship with Russia, but the two of them have very different goals there. But just, you see this, it's almost daily, just these headlines that leap out at you that confirm exactly what the Bible says. And we'll get into more of the Bible prophecy a bit later, but we'll look at some of the scriptures that Mr. Flurry was basing that forecast on, saying, well, Germany and Turkey, they're going to have this close relationship. And then, you know, you see that in your headlines. And you see this kind of thing almost daily. I saw an article this morning in The Atlantic that was basically saying that most Americans don't base their worldview on facts. And as evidence for this, it talked about how many Americans believe the Bible, how many Americans believe in God. And it was basically saying, well, so many Americans believe these things that are obviously irrational, that are obviously not based in facts. Therefore, most Americans live in a fantasy world. That's what that author was arguing. But, you know, look at the facts of what's happening in the world. Look at the facts of how the headlines match what's in the Bible, match these things that we've been saying for years. Fine, people might say that's irrational, but in fact, it is based on facts. It is based on proof. We see this more and more every day, these headlines that just confirm exactly what the Bible says, exactly what people like Mr. Flurry, like Herbert W. Armstrong, have been saying for years. That's the real fact-based, rational worldview. Now, if people were more grounded in history alone as well, though, they'd also be watchful of what's going on between Germany and Turkey. Now, we were talking, we mentioned about Turkey and Russia and about the close relationship that those two have, and that there is there certainly is tension between Germany and Russia, or Germany and Turkey right now. But the thinking within Germany is that, well, inevitably, they're going to end up with us. So we can put the pressure on Turkey, because the relationship with Russia can't last. They're confident that that Turkey's going to end up with them, and for good reason. Russia and Turkey have been enemies for just about all of the Ottoman Empire's history. From even they started kind of clashing to a certain extent from about the mid-16th century onwards. That enmity survived the fall of both the Ottoman and Russian empires. It continued on through the Cold War. The interests of these two powers fundamentally clash. Russia is this huge land power next door to Turkey, desperate for a clear route to the sea that doesn't freeze over in the winter, and one of the shortest routes to that objective goes straight through Turkey. Meanwhile, so that makes Russia a threat to Turkey. Meanwhile, it's almost impossible for Turkey to expand its power in almost any direction without doing so at the expense of Russian power. If Turkey's going to expand in the Balkans, it's got to push back against Russia. If it's going to expand in the Caucasus, well, it's got to push back against Russia. Even with Russia's position in the Middle East, if it starts pushing into the Middle East, it's going to come up against Russia. And that's why these two have been on opposite sides of about a dozen conflicts. In fact, wars between Russia and Turkey are so common in history that historians have pretty much just given up naming them. You just look them up and it's just the Russo-Turkish War of such and such a year to such and such a year. The Russian-Turkan War of this year to that. They're so common that it's not even worth naming them. We just put the dates there. Turkey, they've always been threatened by Russia, and Germany's well aware of this. Germany's Federal Academy for Security Policy, that's a government-run security planning think tank, basically, that is there to advise the government. They wrote that an all-embracing partnership with Russia as an alternative to NATO and Europe is unsustainable for Turkey from an interests policy perspective. So again, they see the same thing, that their interests in the long run don't align with Russia. And so this is behind a lot of the pressure that you see Germany, or the disagreements between Germany and Turkey. And we'll talk a bit more about those and some news on those in the second half of the program. But the way Germany sees it, Turkey's going to be their ally in the long run. Russia's not a sustainable partner for them. So Germany feels they can pile on the pressure without causing a fundamental and long-term breach between the two. And so you do see some disagreements between them now. You do see things like Germany moving its military base away from Turkey. You do see Germany's foreign minister basically threatening Turkey with sanctions or encouraging tourists to stay away from Turkey. But Germany is also confident that in the long run, Turkey is going to be their ally. And like I said, there's a lot of historical precedent for this view as well. So I mentioned earlier, in the form of the Ottoman Empire, Turkey dominated the Middle East, as well as the Balkans, even up into Eastern Europe, and in parts of the Caucasus. And now they're once again becoming a rising power, spreading out through this region that's becoming more and more unstable. Geopolitical Futures, they wrote, studying the Ottomans' history is important because it shows where Turkey is going. They wrote that, noting that Turkey is a very strong country and it's becoming stronger. In their long-run forecast, their kind of the World in 2040 forecast, they wrote that the situation will be, in effect, the return of the Ottoman Empire in Arab territory. And they wrote that they talked about how the Middle East is full of unstable regions, and that Turkey's enemies, in the form of groups like the Islamic State or in the form of Iran, are going to be taking advantage of that instability and pushing into those unstable regions. And that Turkey's got no option but to try and push into those regions itself. Otherwise, it will see its enemies come right up to its own borders. Now, they talked about how it's not going to be easy. And in modern history, Turkey has always relied on an outside power to support it, to supply it with modern weaponry. During the Cold War, the United States filled that role. Russia is now kind of trying to muscle its way into that role. As we said, it's something that's not going to last, but it's trying to do that. But previously, in the early 19th century, Britain fulfilled that role, helping to keep the Ottoman Empire alive, because it didn't want, if it fell, it feared that its enemies would end up moving into the void. And then eventually, towards the end of the 19th century, Germany ended up fulfilling that role. You know, kind of the infamous Helmut von Moltke, he was there in 1835, seconded to the Ottoman Empire to help modernize the army. He felt that he wasn't being listened to. His advice was mostly ignored. But 50 years later, Germany continued this relationship with Turkey. 50 years later, Turkey was much more receptive to German advice. Britain's relationship with Turkey was breaking down then. British troops came into Egypt in 1882 in response to anti-European riots there. And Peter Hopkirk, in his book on Secret Service East of Constantinople, wrote that Bismarck's dynamic new Germany, with its formidable military machine and no apparent designs on Abdulhamid's domain, seemed the most obvious European power to turn to for protection and advice. And that's exactly what Turkey did. So Prussian civil servants went to modernize the Ottoman administration. Germany sent one of its top generals, General Kolmar von der Goltz, to lead a team to modernize the military and also to throw lucrative arms contracts to German industries. And that's why Handelsblatt's piece, Turkish Military Power Made by Germany, also makes history jump off the pages, as well as Bible prophecy. That's something that we saw happening exactly before Germany economic relations took off between the two. And as I mentioned earlier, Germany is currently Turkey's top trading partner. So we see again that happening today. And this trend just kept accelerating after the Ottoman Empire began its genocide of Armenians during the mid-1890s. Well, then European powers became a lot more antagonistic towards Turkey. And so Kaiser Wilhelm took the opportunity to just move even closer to Turkey. Those economic ties accelerated. Germany began to sponsor the construction of the Berlin to Baghdad railway, which went through Ottoman territory, an attempt to link Germany to Asia in a way that couldn't be cut by or threatened by the Royal Navy, very similar to exactly what China is doing with China's Nuke Silk Road project, creating a strong link between Europe and Asia that can't be threatened by a sea power. In this case, the sea power is the United States instead of Britain. And even back then, though, Germany's relationships with Turkey had its ups and downs. The government was overthrown in 1908, and Germany kind of found itself back to square one. But Turkey was key to German ambitions to push into the Middle East, so they kept going. They cultivated one faction who'd overthrown the government in 1908, and in 1913, that faction launched a coup. Its leader was trained in Germany. The German ambassador, if he hadn't planned it, he was at least kept aware of the plans well in advance. The British ambassador at the time wrote that the new government had a distinctly German character. And so they'd worked hard at cultivating this friendship, and it paid off. They had a very German government in charge of the Ottoman Empire. And it wasn't just Turkey's crucial geography that made Germany so keen to cultivate the Ottoman Empire's friendship. It was their religious power, too. The Sultan of Turkey was the Caliph. And many Muslims, even beyond the Ottoman Empire's borders, believed he had the authority to call for holy war, for jihad. And that's what Wilhelm hoped to use. Hopkirk wrote that Germany sought to harness the forces of militant Islam to its cause with the help of its ally, Turkey. By unleashing a holy war against them, Wilhelm and his hawkish advisors aimed to drive the British out of India and the Russians from the Caucasus and Central Asia. It was a bold and adventurous strategy, for there were no precedents for a jihad in modern warfare. And Wilhelm made a lavish trip around the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, went to Jerusalem. He proclaimed himself in Germany the protector of all Muslims. He made sure that the German Secret Service and others made sure that rumors traveled around the empire, and they printed pamphlets, and they spread rumors in mosques that Wilhelm had converted to Islam and that he'd made a secret pilgrimage to Mecca to try and convince the Muslim world that he was on their side. And it's kind of interesting to look at the I mean, this is one of those things that hadn't occurred to me too much until just now, but you look at the role that these European powers have played in building jihad and in proclaiming holy war. Tom Holland, who he's an expert that I respect a lot when it comes to especially the history of Islam, had a documentary recently exploring the links between Napoleon and jihad and about how Napoleon had tried to stir up holy war in the Middle East. So it's interesting. You had Napoleon doing that, Kaiser Wilhelm doing that. Just these connections of these leaders of the Holy Roman Empire in Europe trying to use radical Islam to their own advantage. Now, today, obviously, there's no Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany. But once again, you do have a Germany that wants to get more involved in the Middle East. You had Angela Merkel famously saying back in May, you know, the times that we can fully count on others are somewhat over, as I've experienced in the past few days. And that absolutely includes no longer counting on America to stabilize the Middle East. That's something they want to do themselves now with their own, well, somewhat with military force, but also with their own alliances. Even before then, Germany's 2006 white paper on military reforms talked about Germany's aspirations to, quote, play a substantial role in the many trouble spots in Europe's neighborhood and response and beyond. So they want to play a substantial role in these trouble spots, such as, of course, the Middle East. And if you look at any time Germany's wanted to get involved in the Middle East before, or especially during that time there at the end of the 19th century, earliest 20th century, who was the obvious partner? Who did they turn to? Turkey. It's the traditional partner, it's the obvious partner for them to turn to today. And as Wilhelm's experience there shows, Turkey's turn towards Islam, it doesn't necessarily block this at all. And if anything, it increases Turkey's reach as a potential ally in the Middle East, making it perhaps more valuable because it has much deeper links to the rest of the Middle East that way. And so that's why you see Germany and Turkey, even though quite obviously sparring and there's a lot of sound and fury between the two nations, you start to look at some of the underlying connections and they've not severed them either side. German military companies, yes, there have been some recent blockings of technological weapons transfers to Turkey, but behind the scenes, a lot of the military companies are still cooperating with Turkey and Turkey's still cooperating with Germany when it comes to the migrant crisis. So where is this leading? What is the future? What does the Bible say? Well, Herbert W. Armstrong always taught that Turkey was a descendant of Esau, also known and also called in the Bible as Edom. You can see that a lot in Genesis 35. It lists some of Esau's descendants, and one of his major descendants, I think it was a grandchild, was called Teman, as in the Ottoman Turks. David Vigil, he wrote an article for the Trumpet Print some years ago called East, West, or Neither, that goes through and comprehensively proves the biblical identity of modern Turkey. He talks about, for example, how many of the names used in Central Asia where the Turks came from before they moved to what is now Turkey, how they match names used by Edom or used by Esau's family. He shows how they were moved to Central Asia from the area of Edom biblically. And so you can go and look over that for more proof. But one really clinching piece of evidence comes from Genesis 47 and verse 40 that talks about how Esau would eventually have dominion over the lands of his brother Jacob, while he ruled over the area of Israel, of Jerusalem, that area in the Middle East that Israel ruled for hundreds of years. Well, it was the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire ruled there for about 400 years. So a fulfillment of that prophecy that Esau would, a fulfillment at least in part, rule over that area that used to be owned by Esau's brother Jacob. So what, and that's it, you can go back and you can read David V. Hill's article for more on that. But what does the Bible say about where Turkey, Edom, Esau is heading? Well, one of the most important passages about this is Psalm 83. That's a very important prophecy about Germany's relationships with powers in the Middle East. It talks about a group of Middle Eastern nations that align themselves with Assyria or Germany. It's an alliance, and Assyria is modern Germany. Again, we've got a lot on our website to prove that. But that's an alliance that never happened in history. It's a prophesied alliance. It's describing something for this end time, like so many of the prophecies in the Bible do. It's a prophecy that also dovetails very nicely with a lot of other end time prophecies. So, for example, Daniel 11 talks about a king of the south, a power that is allied with Egypt, with Libya and Ethiopia. The king of the south, as we discussed in our booklet by the same name, is Iranian-led radical Islam. So you have an Iranian camp, and that encompasses many of the Shiite Muslims within the Middle East, as well as Egypt and those nations around Egypt. And then you have in Psalm 83 a separate alliance, an alliance of Sunni powers, mostly that's backed by Germany. And when you look at that list of these Sunni powers, mostly that ally with Germany, well, who's number one, listed first on that list in Psalm 83? It is Edom, Turkey. In that article I mentioned by David Vigil, he writes that Turkey plays a major part in this prophecy. They're a major part of that Psalm 83 alliance. Turkey's also singled out in the book of Obadiah for a major warning, and that's a book all about Turkey. And as we do have a booklet on Obadiah, and as Mr. Flory brings out in that booklet, there's warnings there that apply both to Turkey and also warnings to God's church as well. And he goes through and proves there's a few scriptures in there that confirm that there's more in here than just for the physical nation of Turkey. But that booklet makes clear that book makes clear that it is for modern times. There are parts of that were fulfilled anciently. However, you can look, for example, in Obadiah 1 and verse 15 says, "For the day of the Lord is near." So it's talking about the time before the day of the Lord. There's a few other scriptures or passages in there that make clear that it's for the end times. And it contains a lot of detail, as I said, on Turkey. Obadiah 10 and 11, for example, says, "And your mighty man, O Teman," so again, Ottoman, that we were talking about, a name for Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, "shall be dismayed to the end that every one of the Mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you forever." Verse 11 says, "In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried away captive his forces and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." And in the Obadiah booklet, Mr. Flurry talks about how the historian Josephus records this happening and that 20,000 Edomites were accepted as defenders of Jerusalem in AD 70. And once inside, they betrayed the Jews and robbed and killed them. So that's something that has partially happened, but is something that we're going to see again. The plain truth, they wrote that Turkey will be as one of them. It says in here, it talks about how Turkey will be as one with those nations or allied with those nations that are attacking Israel in the Middle East and America and Britain. They write that Turkey, a Muslim nation, will not be an integral part of the religious political union comprising the restored Roman Empire, but most probably will be linked to it with a military pact or alliance. And then they said, now notice this interesting statement in verse 14. "Neither should you, Edom, have stood in the crossway to cut off those that did escape." And they write, "The crossway is certainly a reference to Turkey's pivotal crossroads position between Europe and Asia, or more specifically to the giant bridge now spanning the Bosporus, a literal crossway between Europe and Asiatic Turkey." The Bosporus Bridge was completed in 1973, and as you heard Mr. Flurry talking about its status there as a crossroads. So Turkey, as I said, it's listed first in the Psalm 83 alliance. It's singled out in Obadiah as being as one with this European power, even though it's not going to be part of that power. It's a strong ally with them. Does that indicate perhaps a certain closeness between Europe and Turkey, more than even the other members of the Psalm 83 alliance, perhaps? Is Turkey kind of both physically and even intellectually or religiously a bridge between Europe and the rest of the Middle East? While they played that role in World War I, they were a bridge for Germany helping to reach out to other Muslim nations. And as Turkey returns to Islam now, could it play that role again? Certainly both physically, geographically, religiously, a power that Germany can use to expand its power into the Middle East. So we're seeing Turkey now get ready to play that role in its alliance with Europe. It's important to note that Turkey, as I said, well, we've covered that. They're not going to be a part of the European power. They'll certainly be allied with it. But we're seeing the exact type of picture from the Bible emerge. You can see from other scriptures that European power is going to be a Catholic-led power, and there's no place for a Muslim Turkey in that power itself. But the Bible is clear that it's going to be allied to it. So we're seeing exactly what is pictured in the Bible emerge. Just over the last year or so, we've seen the final death of Turkey's ambitions to join the European Union. So Turkey is going to play a major role in Europe's schemes in the Middle East. They play a major role in Europe's coming surprise attack on Israel, in the Middle East, and on the US and Britain. Turkey, even as it becomes more and more Islamist and less friendly to America, it still has American nuclear bombs on Turkish soil. They're still trusted with American nuclear weapons. And more analysts, you see, and you saw this last year especially, saying, well, we need to get those bombs out of there. We can't trust Turkey with them. But so far, they're still there. And there are some sobering warnings for Britain, well, and for Turkey in these books, in the book of Obadiah, in the role that Turkey is going to play in end time events, aiding Germany, helping Germany to attack Israel, helping that European power as well to attack Britain and America. But then Obadiah, the book concludes in the final verse there, talking about, I made the mistake of closing my Bible and then writing down the wrong scripture in my notes, writing, and saviors shall come up from the Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the eternal's. So this scripture ends, or this book ends on a very positive note. That is where it's leading. The kingdom, it's leading to the kingdom of God. It's leading to Jesus Christ returning with saviors, with members of his church who he has been training for the last couple of millennia throughout all of the 6,000 years of man's history. Saviors training to come and teach the world the real way of peace. That's where this is leading. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we will go through as many important news stories as time allows.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. One of the best articles I saw from last week was one called Germany's New Power of the Purse from Project Syndicate. It makes some great points, and it also ties in nicely with what we've been talking about in the first half. It talks about how Germany's been throwing its weight around in the latest disagreement between Turkey and Germany. We talked about some of those tensions. But this article talks about how the German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel has been responding to some of the provocations of Turkey against Germany. For example, they recently jailed a German human rights activist. And so Sigmar Gabriel responded by telling German tourists to be careful about visiting Turkey and warning companies about investing there. And this article from Project Syndicate reads, "This amounts to a new German policy towards Turkey, and it further confirms Germany's status as an economic great power." Gabriel's announcement sent shockwaves through the Turkish government, because it recalled Russian President Vladimir Putin's response to Turkey's downing of the Russian warplane in 2015. The sanctions that Russia imposed cost Turkey's already struggling economy $15 billion and eventually forced Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to offer a groveling apology. Putin's aggressive response came as no surprise. By contrast, Germany's decision to respond in a similar fashion makes a break from its generally more accommodating diplomatic style. And they've already, I mean, there's still some tensions between the two, but Turkey did make some pretty quick, significant concessions to Germany. They'd issued a list of to Germany that they said, well, these are a list of terrorists, and they later retracted that list and retracted some of their accusations against German companies. But going back to this article, and this is talking much more about Germany's emerging power, emerging role as an economic great power, they wrote, still, Germany's changing global posture predates Gabriel, who is a relative newcomer at the foreign ministry. During the euro crisis, Germany deployed economic means for economic ends within Europe. But in its policies towards Russia, Turkey, China, and the United States, Germany is increasingly being using its economic strength to advance larger strategic goals. That's what we're seeing now. Germany using economic strength for large strategic goals. It talks about, the article goes on to talk about Putin's annexation of Crimea and about how the West's response was led not by the US, but by Germany, which spearheaded diplomacy with Russia and Ukraine to de-escalate the conflict. They talked about how Germany persuaded the European Union to unite on sanctions and about how it's maintained that united front way longer than a lot of experts thought was possible. And those sanctions are still going. They write that now that Russian-related sanctions loom large over US President Donald Trump's administration, Europeans are increasingly looking to Germany to continue its leadership on this issue. Then they write, of course, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's willingness to confront Trump may be the most surprising foreign policy change of all. Shortly after meeting with Trump at the G7 summit in Sicily in May, and then it talks about the speech about taking our fate into our own hands, and they write that that alone marks a departure from decades of German diplomacy. Then they talk about how Angela Merkel is leading Europe to shore up its relationships with China. They quote a previous German ambassador to Beijing who wrote that Merkel has no illusions about China, but she sees it as a partner on climate trade, and the politics of order, and about how Germany is really leading Europe to diversify its relationship so it's not dependent just on China. I mean, just on the United States. And that's something we've talked about. I think I talked about it on one of the previous times I was on this program fairly recently, on how Europe is expanding its relationship with China and about how that was prophesied in detail in the Bible as well. But going back to this article, they write, Germany's new approach to great power politics has evolved incrementally and in response to seemingly unrelated events. But even if Germany isn't following a master plan, its core strengths have enabled it to leverage its economic power, use EU institutions and budgets as a force multiplier, and build international coalitions of strategic goals. Moreover, Germany's changing diplomacy represents a continuation of the normalization process that began with German reunification in 1989. And it talks about how it's just changing its relationship with all, well, just the way it acts on the world. They write, all of this suggests that Germany may finally be escaping from two complexes that have constrained its strategic thinking. The first is its psycho-historical complex, which forces German leaders to bend over backwards to reassure foreigners about their intentions. And it talks about how Germany is now moving from talking about contributing, not leading, or leading from the middle, to now talking about the idea of servant leadership, is what they call it now. But they're starting to be much more willing to lead. They're moving on from a historic reticence. The second complex, they write, concerns the country's military posture. And they talk about how Germany is talking about spending more, deploying more, using its military more. They write, at the same time, the consensus within the German security establishment about the use of force is changing. Germany's been building bilateral military ties with countries ranging from Norway and the Netherlands to Japan. It has also begun taking a more active role in various theaters of operation by deploying troops in Afghanistan and Mali and providing support for Kurdish fighters in Syria and Iraq. and it is leading efforts alongside France to create an EU defense fund. So these are all, and they write, these are all important developments, but they are nowhere near as important as Germany's decision to bring its massive economic power to bear on the world stage. Gabriel's recent response to Turkey is a step in that direction. Why send troops abroad when you can have a larger impact by keeping tourists and world-class companies at home? And so Germany's starting to become this great power now. They're willing to act like other powers. They're willing to push their weight around, and it's a big change. That's an important article talking on that change. Now, another big story that's in the news a lot right now is North Korea. As I said, they've been really waving their hands for attention. You've had a lot of back and forth just over the past 24 hours with U.S. President Donald Trump threatening them, with North Korea threatening missiles at Guam. One story I saw that just really drove home how much instability North Korea is bringing to the world is this one from the BBC about how Japan is going back to holding bomb drills for the first time in over 70 years to prepare its citizens for the prospect of even a nuclear attack from North Korea. We can play that clip from this BBC program quickly now.
You can hear the siren blaring, and people are hiding behind walls, running inside buildings. Others have run to the local schoolhouse, which is where we've been told they can take refuge. Of course, this is all just a drill, but the fact that a drill like this is happening in Japan is a sign of the times, because no one here has thought about air attack since the end of the Second World War. But in the last 6 months or so, these sorts of drills have started happening in towns and villages all along this Sea of Japan coast.
Certainly is a sign of the times, as he said there, a sign of the dangerous world we live in. One thing that really jumped out at me on the North Korea news from the last few days is this one from the Washington Post that's been making a lot of rounds, called North Korea now making missile-ready nuclear weapons, U.S. analysts said. They talked about how an analysis from the Defense Intelligence Agency completed a month ago warns that Japan has successfully produced a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside its missiles, crossing a key threshold on the path to becoming a fully fledged nuclear power, it writes. And you know, that one obviously really stood out to me, because I've been I wrote an article just a couple of weeks ago on this subject, talking about how you see all of these analysts saying that, well, North Korea can't fit a nuclear weapon on a missile. You know, there have been all of these excuses in the US media about why you don't really need to worry about North Korea. And you've just seen them busted so quickly. They were saying, well, North Korea can't fit a nuclear missile or can't fit a nuclear weapon on a missile. And as I wrote back in that article a few weeks ago, I'm certainly no expert on North Korea, but if you look at what the actual experts on North Korea are saying, they were saying all at the time that the media was saying this, actually, North Korea almost certainly can fit a nuclear bomb on a missile. But it was just the media kind of trying to put this comforting spin on everything while the experts were saying things quite differently. And now you have this coming out of the Defense Intelligence Agency, out of an agency designed to just much closely monitor and have secret sources on what North Korea is up to. There's another story on that. There we go. I thought I was missing something. Two pages had stuck together. Another story on North Korea from CNBC called North Korea's number two official strengthened ties with Iran as UN hits Pyongyang with new sanctions. And they wrote that amid new international sanctions, North Korea's number two official embarked on a 10-day visit to Iran, a move that could result in the two sides expanding their ties. And so he's there for around 10 days. North Korea is opening a new embassy in Tehran. This article goes on to quote quite a few more experts talking about cooperation between the two. Callum Woods working on an article that we'll have up on our website pretty soon on thetrumpet.com talking about this. So you see North Korea becoming more and more dangerous with nuclear weapons that can reach the United States, with bombs that can fit on missiles that can reach America, and then more and more cooperation with Iran, this regime that openly talks about how they want to start World War III and about how they believe that that will bring about the return of the Mahdi, the return of their Messiah equivalent, basically. It's a very dangerous situation there. And as you heard from the BBC, just a sign of the times. He probably doesn't realize it, but that's something that comes right out of the Bible. And it is a sign that we're in the end times. Now, I have a ton more news articles that I'm going to have to move over to one side that we're not going to have time to get to. I believe Mr. Stephen Flurry will be back on the show tomorrow. That's about it from me. Obviously, you can keep looking at our website just to keep up to date with all of these speedy developments that we see every day now confirming Bible prophecy. So keep watching that, or keep watching the website, keep listening to the show, and keep sending us your emails at td@kpcg.fm.